You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
we have a Congress that explicitly blocks us from even collecting data on how we could potentially reduce gun deaths. How can that be? This is a political choice that we make to allow this to happen every few months in America.
Even the usually eloquent Barack Obama sounds almost lost for words as the United States reacts to yet another mass shooting by doing the same things it always does in such circumstances, arguing and then nothing. My guests Daniela Pellet and James Boyes will discuss that and the day's other top stories, including talks in Paris about Russia's interference in Ukraine become talks about Russia's interference in Syria. Benjamin Netanyahu continues his charm offensive.
And here's my message to all the countries represented here. Whatever resolutions you may adopt in this building, whatever decisions you may take in your capitals, Israel will do whatever it must do to defend our state and to defend our people.
And we'll ask the unthinkable, and indeed think the unaskable. Could next year's American presidential election actually pit Bernie Sanders against Donald Trump? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellet, editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and contributor to Haaretz, among other journals, and James D. Boyes, historian and author of books, including The Imminent Hillary Rising. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Paris, where President Vladimir Putin of Russia has spent much of this afternoon being yelled at for bombing Syria by the leaders of the other countries which were already bombing Syria. France, Turkey, the United States, the United Kingdom, Qatar and Saudi Arabia have all kept straight faces as they expressed concern that any further addition to the tonnage already being dropped on the various forces fighting Bashar al-Assad's military and or each other will somehow fuel extremism and radicalism as apparently opposed to what has been going on these last few years. Daniela, we discussed this with James last night on the Monocle Daily, and we discussed the argument, weird though it now find it feels, to sort of take Vladimir Putin's side on this even slightly, but hasn't he got a case that Russia actually has a greater claim to legitimacy for its participation here, given that it is protecting its direct national interests in terms of its military bases, and the actually recognised government of Syria has invited it to do so?
The actually recognised government of Syria
being Bashar al-Assad. I mean, no one likes him or anything, but he is still the government.
This is, I think, what's alarming about the whole thing, especially watching the media in Britain and I'm sure other places talking about it. Now it's become accepted. Well, you know what? Assad is not that bad. You know, he's our bastard as opposed to all the other ones. And this has become a self-fulfilling prophecy. He must be rubbing his hands in glee and delight.
Because this was the thinking that Assad has been holding out for, was it? This has always been his line, basically. I may be awful, but anything that follows me would be worse.
I actually heard, a retired British Army general on the radio this afternoon describe him as not terribly nice. So he's not a terribly nice chap, that's right. But the alternative is worse. I mean, I think what is astonishing about this, and one shouldn't really be surprised, is the amazing chutzpah of the Russians here, who are saying, I mean, I think they have maybe hit a couple of ISIS-related targets today, but they started their bombing campaign saying, right, we're going after Islamic State, when they were bombing absolutely nowhere near Islamic State. And, you know, is it better to be hit by a precise Russian weapon that's very much more powerful but can be targeted than a barrel bomb from Assad, which is just random and frightening but has fewer casualties? I mean, that's going to be the situation now in Aleppo and Homs.
James, Russia's other argument, and I mean, the chutzpah is not to be sneezed at, but we are talking about a country that still maintains that it didn't actually invade Ukraine at any point. Mm-hmm. But their argument is still, or at least the argument they are attempting to promote, is the idea that any way forward for Syria, if indeed there is one, does involve a transition that has to involve the Assads. And again, I am playing devil's, if not the Kremlin's advocate, slightly here. But given what happened next door in Iraq in 2003-04, when America, with extraordinary stupidity, fired the entire Iraqi military and the Ba'ath Party, is it not at least the case that you have to work with what structure there actually is if you want something, if you want to start from a position of other than total anarchy?
Yeah, I mean, the terrible thing is, I mean, it would be lovely to sit here and take an idealist approach and say, hey, you know what, we should get rid of all evil people and replace them with lovely, nice, sort of liberal, democratically appointed people from the West.
It's not a bad idea.
It's not a bad idea. Hang on, it's a lovely idea. Unfortunately, the world isn't always like that. And I'm going to start sounding like Henry Kissinger, I know, which I do apologize
for. Can you do the voice?
To both of you. what can I say? I'm going to change this. The problem you've got ultimately is, as we saw, and Danielle's looking at me rather incredulously at this point, and I'm not surprised.
That's horror, not
no horror. Okay, is that
aghast
we tried
was
that?
The word I was going to
we
use.
Tried that in Iraq, and look what happened. You know, you try to come in and utterly change these places, and it becomes chaos. I am no way advocating, by the way, retention of Assad. He's an SOB, and the sooner he goes, the better. Quite frankly. What is the West meant to do at this point? The challenge you've got is nobody wants him to stay in control. Nobody wants the Russians involved. Nobody wants IS to take over. And the rebels, nobody quite is understanding who they are, where they are, or what their backgrounds are. It is an utter mess, which has been, in many ways, exacerbated by the utter failure of the West to come up with a coherent policy with which to either engage Assad directly, which we should have done years ago, or to get behind any viable alternative to him, which should have been done years ago. And as a result, you've got a void in the region, which Putin has nicely stepped into, and is just exacerbating tensions and differences between the West. And as a result, he's just fostering more and more chaos in that world, which will only make things worse for the poor people on the ground and extend Assad's stay in power, which nobody around this table, I think, would want to advocate the slightest.
Daniela, you were looking aghast. Please elaborate.
I'm even more aghast. No, I really take exception with this sort of attitude that I think that we have to throw our hands up and there's nothing that we can do because people in this part of the world, well, what can you do with them? That's how it is. In the Middle East, they only understand force. Things can only be stable under a strong dictator. I'm sorry, that's not... I just don't believe that. I don't believe that. I think there's people... The facts... back me up. People in Iraq did turn out for elections. They do want democracy. They do want peace and self-determination. And I don't think you can expect after the absolute atrocities that the Assad regime has been inflicting for decades, but the last 4 years, beyond all imagination, people to say, well, okay, you know, but he's a strong man. We can respect him. He's a strong man. And we hold our hands up and say, okay, that's how it's always been in this region. And right. It's better for us. It's easier for us. Our region will be more stable and we'll have stability at all costs and things will be safer for us in the West. I just think that's redundant thinking.
I didn't actually say that. I didn't actually say he should be retained in power at all. What I'm saying is that the way the Americans went about it in terms of decapitating the leadership, I was actually agreeing with what Andrew was saying in terms of how that shouldn't be allowed to happen. We need to have regime change there, but it needs to be done in a fashion which does not result in the utter chaos that you saw in Iraq, you know, the de-Ba'athification process. What I'm advocating is the fact that there should have been a coherent policy in that part of the world years ago, but nobody wanted to get involved, least of all the President of the United States, who was so busy trying to withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan. He didn't want to get involved in this part of the world. We were talking about this before we came on air. And you've got an abdication of leadership from the West. And all the only people who are suffering on the ground now are the people, you know, who, you know, we would want, I think, to help and alleviate the suffering from. It's a woeful situation. There seems to be no great solution, quite frankly, at this point. It's certainly not going to be a military solution.
Well, On that happy note, and I suspect we will have ample opportunity to return to Syria, but let's look now at the United States, where for the 15th time in his presidency, Barack Obama has been obliged to issue a statement in the aftermath of a mass slaughter by the kind of person that no other developed country would have allowed anywhere near automatic weapons. It is worth noting that Obama has not issued a statement after every such event that's occurred on his watch, because if he did, he would do nothing else. Yesterday's massacre at Umpqua Community College in Roseburg, Oregon, was the 994th mass shooting to have occurred in America during his second term alone. This is some of what the president had to say.
Somehow this has become routine. The reporting is routine. My response here at this podium ends up being routine. The conversation in the aftermath of it, we've become numb to this. We've talked about this after Columbine and Blacksburg, after Tucson, after Newtown, after Aurora, after Charleston. It cannot be this easy for somebody who wants to inflict harm on other people to get his or her hands on a gun. And what's become routine, of course, is the response of those who oppose any kind of common sense gun legislation. Right now, I can imagine the press release is being cranked out. We need more guns, they'll argue. Fewer gun safety laws. Does anybody really believe that?
Daniela, first of all, I don't know how extemporized or pre-written that was. I think that's one of the most impressive pieces of oratory he's ever delivered, and hopefully it will be one of the most resonant. But there was an extraordinarily, from a naturally optimistic man, there's a terribly despondent tone to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It was, he clearly exasperated. And it's very bizarre sitting and looking at it from this side of the Atlantic at these mass gun shootings seem to have been become as much part of American culture and life as an epidemic of obesity, which just we seem to have accepted it. This is the new America. And I was looking at some surveys before we came on, and it seems that support for freedom of availability of guns only gets higher in America the more of these shootings there are. I imagine it's down to the perception that it's more and more dangerous, therefore we need more and more guns to protect ourselves.
James, why don't the parameters of this argument ever move? I'm putting in mind at this point of a guest we had discussing a previous shooting on this program once, and I did ask them if they could even imagine at this point the gun incident that would be so terrible and so dreadful that Americans would actually rethink it seriously, to which he replied, "How many more presidents do you want us to shoot?" to which I had no good answer. Why doesn't it change? It is surely not. I mean, surely anybody can see how insane this is.
I think one of the challenges is here that there is an ingrained cultural recognition of the right to bear arms that if you are not an American, it's very difficult to try to understand. I'm very fortunate in the job I have that I get to meet and teach a good number of American students who come from across the country of all different backgrounds, genders, etc., etc. And they all want to bear arms. It doesn't matter whether you are from, you know, a guy from down south who wants to maintain a gun to go hunting, or whether you're a female student of mine from New England who wants to carry a pink gun in her purse. You know, their attitude is, I'm an American, I've got the right to bear arms. If the government bans guns, the only people who will not carry guns will be law-abiding citizens who will be at the whim and the mercy of criminals who will keep their guns. Now, again, please don't think I am sitting here saying that's correct, but that is the cultural difference between Europeans and Americans who have been brought up with the Second Amendment rights, and that constitution is so important to them. I mean, whether we agree with it or not, it is the fundamental tenet of American life. And one of them at the moment says you've got the right to bear arms. And when I hear the president, you were talking about how impressed you were, but I'm just constantly appalled by the amount of times he gets up and basically says, "Don't blame me, Gov. I'm only the president of the United States. Don't expect me to do anything about it." He's been president for almost 8 years, and nothing has happened under his watch on this.
It's not for want of some trying on his part, but the thing is, the president can't do these things by executive fiat.
Well, the president can do an awful lot of things by presidential fiat if he wants to do so. He can also engage in a public debate. It's important to remember also, whilst I've got the mic, that for the first 2 years of his presidency, the Democrats controlled both the White House and the Congress with a supermajority. You saw what he could ram through when he wanted to get healthcare reform through. If they'd wanted to do something with regard to guns, if you believe this is a left-right issue, which many people do, then the Democrats could have done a great deal to basically reduce gun ownership in the United States. They didn't, because it is not a politically popular move to take for anybody in the United States at this point.
That's certainly true. But Daniela, is it arguable that maybe in the unlikely event that a Republican president wanted to have a crack at this, that a Republican might have better luck with it than a Democrat? In the same way I'm thinking of, I realise that my own homeland of Australia and America have a very different relationship with guns, but it was a conservative Prime Minister John Howard who, after the Port Arthur massacre in 1996, implemented a huge buyback program. And it turned out to be a very popular and effective one to get long-barreled weapons out of civilian circulation.
To be honest, I'm not sure about that. It's the same line of thinking that goes, well, you know, only a right-wing Israeli prime minister could bring about peace between Israel and the Palestinians, because it did happen once with the Egypt-Israel peace deal. But I think that it has gone, it's gone almost to become a tenet of religion. The way it seems from here in America, the right to bear arms without any, you know, James is talking about the most extreme version. People think they're going to have their guns taken away from them. And no one is talking about that. They're talking about some sort of controls or heightening controls. And I think there was an attempt a couple of years ago to do just that. It failed. Every time this happens, support for gun ownership grows. I mean, the smallest amount, a small advance would be encouraging in terms of restrictions. Don't seem to be able to get there at all.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellet and James Boyce. Coming up next, winning friends and influencing people with Benjamin Netanyahu.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
What we're trying to do is to keep our tentacles spread far and wide, I suppose, for this vast, vast country and this really dynamic city too here in Toronto, to try and bring the most accurate and the most vibrant flavour we can of this place that we hold so dearly to us.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Daniela Pellet and James Boyce. Now, among the most anticipated highlights of any General Assembly of the United Nations is the turn by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Yesterday's speech was not, perhaps, of quite the same class as his performance in 2012, which he memorably illustrated with a picture of something apparently looted from the arsenal of Wile E. Coyote, but it was still pretty special. Netanyahu floated the possibility of a coalition of my enemy's enemies, suggesting that the threat posed by Islamic State would forge closer bonds between Israel and its usually rancorous Arab neighbours. Daniela.
Yes. This is one year where I have to admit I did not play the usual Netanyahu UN speech drinking game. You have to take a shot of whiskey for Iran, Hamas, Rock, etc., etc.
If you had played that game, you would probably not be sitting here now.
No, exactly.
You would be on a couch with a cold compress.
I've given up. But I think what was my takeaway from this year's speech was that, in a way, he was sort of wishing a sad farewell to the whole Iran issue. I think there's been an acceptance that really this is it. He's done as much as he can. All this brave fighting to try and convince the Americans that the deal was a bad idea, you know. Defeat has been conceded.
There was still a bit of thunderbolt hurling on that front, though. He did, as we played that clip at the top of the programme, still reminding everybody that you can do whatever deals you like, but if Israel feels it has to protect itself, it will do what it's going to do.
Well, he's been there several times before when he's actually, you know, according to reports, asked the army to prepare and been there. But I think he recognises at the moment this is more off the table than it has been. And I think it's one of the reasons he was trying to ramp up international support, diplomatic support for a diplomatic effort against Iran was, you know, the idea of military action isn't by no means supported in all parts of the Israeli military or Israeli intelligence groups.
James, what did you make of his idea that there was, in the threat posed by Islamic State to everybody in the region, perhaps some sort of makings of some thing that Israel could work with together with its Arab neighbours?
It's possible. If you think about the idea that, let's be honest about it. I mean, where else is Israel going to go at this point? I mean, as Daniel Wright points out, the opposition to the Iran deal is pretty much over now. It's expected that he's going to meet with the president in the next 2 weeks at the White House and basically accept the package deal that the Obama administration is offering as a sweetener, effectively, for going along with this. So the opposition there is null and void. ISIS have clearly emerged as the greatest existential threat to many in that part of the world. So why not try to make some mileage out of that at this point? I mean, whether we'll get any joy out of it, I don't know. I thought the most interesting thing that he did at that speech is something you could not have played on the radio, of course, which was a 45-second silence.
If only they had played it on the radio.
Well, that would have confused and confounded everybody. It was fascinating, though, and I was also hearing that, by all accounts, the US ambassador, Samantha Power, was ordered not to be in the room to hear the address by the Israeli Prime Minister, which, if it's true, is quite remarkable, quite frankly.
On the subject of Islamic State and Israel, though, Daniela, Israel have struck targets in Syria during this conflict, not, as far as we're aware at least, actual Islamic State targets. But among Israel's people and among Israel's media, how great a concern is Islamic State, or are they still more focused on more proximate worries?
Oh, it's become, I think, as in many places around the world, a kind of cipher for this sort of amorphous threat of the Islamization of the world. I mean, one of Netanyahu's campaign videos showed a group of pseudo-Islamic State fighters driving through what was supposed to be Israel, firing their guns, and they stop at a traffic light, and a man wearing a sort of peace now, like left-wing T-shirt. They ask him, which way is Jerusalem? And he says, oh, turn left at the lights and go there. You know, the basic idea being the left, you know, by accepting a two-state solution, is going to give over Israel to the Islamist horde. So I think they've made an awful lot of capital on that. But really, the relations that Israel has with its Arab neighbours, from pragmatic reasons, are not too bad. Relations Egypt, good. Lots of interests in common. Jordan, the same thing. Saudi Arabia, really not too bad either. And certainly over the whole Iran issue, it had a lot of tacit support from states that were also not too keen on Iran.
Just a final thought on this one, Daniela. We also saw this week a declaration by Mahmoud Abbas that Palestinians are no longer bound by the Oslo Accords. How significant is that?
Well, it was supposed to be a bombshell, but I feel quite sorry for the poor old chap. He's 80 years old. You know, he doesn't have many more rabbits to pull out of the bag. It's all words, but really, when it comes down to it, is he really going to say, OK, we stop security cooperation and we dismantle the PA? I mean, that is the kind of, that is the sort of nuclear option. But he knows that he and his constituents have got too much to lose for that. So, I mean, we had also had the symbolic raising of the Palestinian flag at the UN, which is very, very symbolic. But it doesn't seem that Abbas's tactic of going for international recognition and all the symbolic attributes of statehood is going to get very far now.
Okay, well, finally tonight, here in Britain, we have been learning the hard way of late that when a patently unelectable socialist seeks the leadership of a major political party, the smart move might be to stifle one's incredulous laughter long enough to throw a few quid on them. You can't get the 200-1 on Bernie Sanders that you could get on new Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn at one point, but the 6-1 still available on the senator from Vermont is starting to look tempting, following the greatest inflow of small donations in American electoral history, outstripping even Obama in 2008-2012. James, I wanted to use this cue to raise an entertaining hypothetical.
Which, you talk about my book, don't you?
your book, Hillary Rising, available in January, I believe.
I hope so.
is it possible that Western politics are in fact being transformed and upended in ways we don't yet quite understand, and that, you know, towards the end of next year, we will be counting down to a presidential contest between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders?
No. I don't believe so. I think what you're seeing, quite frankly...
We've got five more minutes, James.
Yeah, I can, oh, listen, I can talk and talk and talk. There's no problem on that front. I think that with regard to what you're seeing in the United States is not that dissimilar to what you've seen here in the United Kingdom, which is a massive pushback against, you know, the New Labour, New Democrat program, plan, effectively, of the 1990s. You know, we've seen that with Corbyn here. And I think in the United States, there is... a sort of an ABC approach, which isn't anybody but Clinton within some parts of the Democratic Party. Now, I don't think that's going to amass to a majority that will be able to prevent her from getting the nomination and then potentially the presidency. But there's no doubt about it that there is a core group of people within the left of the Democratic Party. You would rather take the party back to a pre-Bill Clinton, pre-New Democrat era on the perfectly understandable basis that they want the party of the left to be a party of the left and not a moderate middling, effectively. And I think we saw that to a degree with some of the support that Jeremy Corbyn got in this country. You're seeing it in the United States. What I think is interesting is the way in which in the United States, Bernie Sanders has got a particular appeal with a particular part of the country. So in his native Vermont, for example, you know, a leftist center state, if you go to the Pacific Northwest, for example, places like Washington, Oregon, he's getting huge crowds there, for example. The test will be, however, is how he can deal with other demographics, how he's going to do if he moves out of the north, out of Iowa and New Hampshire, for example, and starts heading south into South Carolina, into Florida, dare I say the deep south. And so I think that when the demographics of the United States come into play and you move away from the sort of the liberal northeast, for example, he's going to really suffer, and Hillary will, I think, rise, dare I say.
Nicely
elegantly
done.
Elegantly done, James.
Thank you very much.
Daniela, it strikes me, I'd be interested to know what you think, that both Trump and Sanders, and actually to an extent Corbyn, appeal, despite their ideological differences, to essentially the same kinds of people. They are people who are resentful for one reason or another of the status quo. There's a real nostalgia, I think, possibly for an age which never actually existed among all their fan clubs. Are there enough of those people to get a candidate over the line, though?
Well, there might be, but not to get them elected. I mean, I think of these sort of frankly apocalyptic visions we're seeing of, you know, Jeremy Corbyn having a meeting with Donald Trump, you know, in their
both to discuss unmarked tanks crossing the border from Russia into Estonia. You can wake screaming in the night thinking about this stuff. You really can.
You can, and it's kind of quite delicious to imagine it in the same way as a sort of late night horror film. But I don't think it's a likely scenario.
Because the other thing that strikes me, though, is that, and we have one or two characters like that in British politics, Jeremy Corbyn, also the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, who, despite continually doing and saying things that would be career-ending for any other politician, it just appears to make them even stronger. Are Trump and Sanders that kind of exception?
Well, I mean, I've spoken a little bit about Bernie Sanders, so let me just pivot a little bit, not to the Pacific, but to Donald Trump. I think what you're seeing with Trump is a continuation of a progress of the rise of the celebrity candidate and the celebrity politician. You know, whether that's Arnold Schwarzenegger, whether it's Jesse Ventura, you could go back, you could even bring Ronald Reagan into this, quite
certainly,
frankly, if you go back far enough. So I think that Trump is that continuation, the latest incarnation of a blend of politics and entertainment, which you've seen over the years in the United States. He's the latest example of it. I mean, you know, it also demonstrates the lack of depth that you can get away with in American politics and bring everything down to a soundbite. I think the greatest danger for the GOP, though, is not him getting the nomination. It's a sense that the GOP will try to block him from getting the nomination, that the GOP will coalesce around anybody but Trump candidate, and he'll say, all right, fair enough, if you're not going to play ball, I'm going to take my billions of dollars and I will run as an independent candidate. I'll take my ego and I will split the vote on the right and I'll give the election to whoever emerges as a Democratic candidate.
Okay, well, finally from each of you then, and I probably won't remember this long enough to hold it against you a year or so from now, who do you think will be the two nominees? Daniela?
Jeremy Corbyn.
The two American nominees, who's it going to be?
Oh, Clinton and I couldn't say. We were discussing this earlier. I'll leave this up to David because he is the expert.
James?
Thank you very much. I'm going to go with Marco Rubio and Hillary Clinton.
You'd better be hoping Clinton, obviously.
Absolutely.
We will have to leave it
there. Best interest.
Daniela Pellard and James Boyes, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federica Romaniello. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Tom Edwards is in with Monocle's international playlist. Marcus Hippie follows him at 1900 with the menu. At 2200, it's the Monocle Daily tonight, hosted by Emma Nelson here in London and Thomas Lewis from our Toronto Bureau. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and have a great weekend.